NPR.
From Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the local edition. I'm Jason Dole. Thank you so much for being here with me tonight. It is the 11th day of September, and on the show tonight, Patricio Rubio will talk to Beth Hillman, President and CEO of the 9/11 Memorial and Museum in New York City. That conversation's coming up in the second half of our program. But first, as usual on a Thursday evening, we have the latest news for the Catskills and Hudson Valley from the Times Union. Joining me on the phone for that is Philip Pantuso, Times Union Hudson Valley. Philip, welcome back to the local edition.
Good to be with you.
Well, let's get started with another update on a story we've talked about a bunch. It seems like every week brings another update in the story of the lawsuit that Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton has brought against Ulster County's acting clerk, Taylor Brooke. And now New York's Attorney General is entering the fray. We gave people the basics of this two nights ago based on your reporting on this. Were you surprised?
I was not surprised. You know, this is a sort of turn of the wheel update, but a pretty significant one because it is the Attorney General invoking an authority that she has under the state constitution to step into a case that concerns state policy or state law, as this one quite clearly does. Just as a reminder, that's the shield law that protects providers of abortion medication who mail pills to patients in other states, protects them from being prosecuted, and it protects, or it basically mandates that other public officials, including people such as county clerks, are not able to participate in those prosecutions. So, you know, as we've talked about before, this case has been headed toward this type of showdown, I think. This is basically the first real serious attempt by an anti-abortion state to penetrate the laws of a state like New York that protects abortion health care. And naturally, that is that's the sort of standoff that seems destined to head to the federal courts. The argument that Texas Attorney General has made here is that this violates the full faith and credit clause of the Constitution, which generally requires that states recognize the judicial decisions of other states, and the extradition clause, which is related, which mandates that states return individuals charged with crimes to the state where the alleged crime occurred. So the Attorney General stepping in, functionally, really what this means is that it's now a state of Texas case versus the state of New York case, even though the defendant is still Taylor Brooke. The New York Attorney General's office is going to be representing the state of New York's interest in the case from now on.
Okay, yeah, and that's what I wanted to ask you, because as you say in the article, like, this intervention by AG James basically puts New York's top lawyer directly between AG Paxton and Taylor Brooke in Ulster County. So we've talked a lot about Brooke's representation. You know, the Ulster County legislature approved a certain amount of funds for his representation. He had also procured pro bono representation. So does he still have those other folks representing him?
Yes. My understanding of this is that James is representing the state of New York's interest here. Now, clearly, the defendant in the case, you know, remains Taylor Brooke, the acting clerk, and he still has a lawyer who is being paid for by the county up to $50,000, and then he will work pro bono. But because the case concerns a New York state law, it is of interest to New York state as a political entity. And that is what Attorney General James is going to be defending in court. She said in a statement to me that her office plans to file a legal filing later this month, arguing that Texas cannot commandeer New York's courts to enforce, quote, punitive abortion laws. and that New York has the, quote, legal right and responsibility to safeguard its residents, its providers, and its courts from out-of-state overreach.
Right. And that's how she was framing this in another statement, too. It is basically saying this is about another state's extreme laws trying to be exported to New York. Of course, Texas has a very different view of this, but this does kind of feel like the showdown that this seemed like this would be heading towards from the first time that we were reporting on this.
Yeah. And, you know, the way I mentioned this a second ago, but the legal arguments that Paxton and Texas are making are clearly designed to get this into a federal court jurisdiction at some point. Like, there's no way that an argument that one state is violating the U.S. Constitution is going to be decided in that state's court.
And the last thing I want to ask you on this is Brooke's reaction. What was his reaction to this news from A.G. James?
Well, it was kind of interesting. I'll take you behind the curtain briefly. I reached out to him to seek a comment. And in doing so, I guess officially informed him that this was happening. This was over the weekend. He did not yet know that this was officially going to happen, although of course he was aware that that it was being discussed. So he was, he was pretty happy about it. It helps to have the attorney general of the state in which you reside on your side. He told me that this action underscores the attorney general's office's deep commitment to defending New York Shield Law. He said he was proud to have their support in this fight, as well as the support of the attorney that he hired a few weeks ago now.
Okay, well, Philip, thank you for that update there. Now, on to our next story. This is about healthcare in New York State, and we've been talking a lot in recent weeks about state healthcare, but also specifically about the state comptroller, DiNapoli, criticizing the Department of Health. And this latest story is that the state comptroller, DiNapoli, has found that state health department spent about $1.2 billion for non-New York residents. What is this about?
Yeah, so State Comptroller's Office, Thomas DiNapoli, has been auditing several parts of the sprawling State Department of Health, in particular the Medicaid program, and they came out with a report, I believe it was just earlier this week, finding that New York may have improperly paid as much as $1.2 billion to people who live outside of the state via payments through the Medicaid managed care program. This report covers a period between 2017 and 2024. And it found basically that the Department of Health was not really checking to see if people who had enrolled in managed care programs under Medicaid, perhaps while living in New York State, if they were still living in New York State as they were continuing to receive payments.
Okay, so that seems to be a pretty significant find.
Yeah, that's because, you know, nearly a third of all New Yorkers receive assistance for healthcare through the state's Medicaid program, and a big chunk of these improper payments were made through these managed care programs. Apparently, of that $1.2 billion overpayment, something like $509 million of it was made to more than 155,000 people who had managed care plans at one point in the state of New York, but may no longer be living in New York. Now, it's worth noting that there are a couple of bits of context to say here. One is that the State Department of Health spokeswoman said that part of the issue was a legal requirement during the COVID-19 pandemic that prohibited states from ending Medicaid coverage, even despite a change in residency. So she says that a lot of those payments happened when people may have moved out of New York during the COVID pandemic, but still required Medicaid assistance. And they said that they have resolved issues and that this is really no longer a problem.
Okay, so that's like the official response from State Department of Health.
Yeah, it is. Still not like the best look for them, given that the federal government and Republicans in in this state and a lot of other states, and some Democrats too, have long criticized Medicaid, the Medicaid program, for being inefficient and wasteful.
And it's also growing, the Medicaid here. So any other takeaways from this story?
I guess just the larger takeaway that, you know, this, I think it's probably fair to say that this increased scrutiny from the Comptroller's Office on the health department, and in particular Medicaid, you know, some of these audits have been underway for a while now, but it comes as the Trump administration is threatening pretty significant cuts to Medicaid. And so it seems to be an attempt to try to clean it up, you know, as much as possible in advance of what will likely be a diminished support for the program coming from the federal level.
Right. So part of the state's ongoing preparations to deal with changes coming at the federal level. I'm talking to Philip Pantuso, Times Union, Hudson Valley. Philip, let's stay on the state of New York State's healthcare. And you've got a story about New York scaling back its essential plan, which that's something that's supposed to help out lower income folks.
Yeah, I basically set myself up here with that, with that transition. So state health officials on Wednesday said that they're going to scale back the essential plan, which is a fully subsidized medical care plan for low-income New Yorkers, which they called a, quote, proactive action to hopefully prevent further cuts to that plan. As a result, some 450,000 people are expected to lose access to the essential plan. So for those unfamiliar, the essential plan is a state health insurance coverage plan that sort of targets that gap between like low-income people who might not be able to afford decent or any health insurance on the marketplace and people who make too much money to qualify for Medicare or Medicaid. Right. And it's been around for a while. There are 1.7 million New Yorkers enrolled in it now. But last year, the state expanded the eligibility by lowering the by changing the income cutoff, basically. So really, what they're doing here is they're going to reverse that change, which will make it. What they're really going to do here is they're going to scale back that change from last year to make it so that people who make up to 200% of the federal poverty level will qualify as opposed to 250%.
The headline is New York will shift 450,000 New Yorkers off essential plan, blaming Trump. So, again, the thread kind of running through these stories, it seems to me this is a further tightening of the belt, getting ready for further cuts to come down from the federal level.
Yeah. A health policy expert with the Empire Center for Public Policy said that this move should save New York roughly $3 billion of its own funds that it would otherwise have had to shell out to cover mandatory populations through Medicaid. I think I said this before, but this program is entirely subsidized, and it has, to this point, largely relied on funding from the federal government that is likely not going to come anymore. So New York is basically trying to save itself a little bit of money here.
Okay, and for this next story, and for regular listeners of Radio Catskill, if you're listening, yesterday the news was talking about the efforts of the Trump administration to create like a national voter registry database. We're hearing that in the headlines and a feature interview on Fresh Air yesterday. But you have reporting that the Trump administration has already subpoenaed three upstate counties in New York for their voter information.
Yeah, this is something that we uncovered this week, starting with a subpoena that was sent to the Ulster County Board of Elections on, I believe it was Tuesday. It was a subpoena from the Department of Homeland Security delivered by an ICE agent, apparently, in person, seeking the voter registration information for just one particular voter who resides in Ellenville. And as a result of that, we did some digging, called some other county elections commissioners, and found that at least a couple more had also received subpoenas in recent months. In Saratoga County, they received, I think it was 3 subpoenas for the voter information and records of 3 registered voters up there. And Putnam County also received subpoenas, although they would not tell us any details about what those subpoenas were seeking, what records they were seeking. And we filed a Freedom of Information request, but they have not fulfilled it yet. This comes amid an effort by the Trump administration nationally to build a voter database. They're basically compiling voter roll data as part of an attempt to kind of check to see whether undocumented people in this country have been voting, which is of course not legal for them to do. That's something Trump has long claimed, with basically no evidence. Studies that have actually looked at this indicate that undocumented people in this country voting is quite rare and very sporadic. There's really no evidence of there being any kind of systematic effort to register undocumented people or undocumented people registering to vote.
Yeah.
And something that the Ulster County election commissioner, the Democratic commissioner, told us is that they don't even really, most of these counties don't even maintain records about whether or not somebody is or is not like a legal resident of this country. When you go to register to vote at a DMV or wherever you do it, you identify as being a citizen or not. And if somebody says they're not a citizen, that voter registration just is never submitted to the Board of Elections. If they are, the Board of Elections gets it, but they have no authority really to like check whether everybody who registered to vote is a citizen. There are other agencies that are supposed to be doing that. So we don't really know what was behind these efforts. We only know the larger national context in which it's playing out.
And that it was an ICE agent that brought this request to the Board of Elections in Ulster County.
Something. Yeah.
What's the Ulster Board of Elections response?
They said that they intend to comply with the subpoena in the coming days, which that means they're going to, turn over this information. That commissioner did say that there's no indication that this person who had identified as being a citizen, there's no evidence that they have actually voted in an election, and we don't know their residency status. So, but we can infer that there's some questions about it, I guess, if DHS is seeking that information.
All right. Well, thank you. And more information on this story and all the stories that we've been talking about are up now at timesunion.com. We've been talking to Philip Pantuso, Times Union Hudson Valley. Philip, thanks again.
You got it. Take care.
And we've got more news coming right up here on September 11th. We talked to the CEO of the 9/11 Memorial and Museum in New York City. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
There's no person who can replace Charlie Kirk. It's pretty unchallengeable that he was singularly gifted at the art of speaking with fluency and a total conviction about the virtues of conservatism as practiced by Donald Trump.
I'm Michael Barbaro. That's Today on the Daily from the New York Times.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Calicoon Theater, an updated vintage movie theater with new releases, film festivals, nostalgic screenings, live music events, and more. Information and schedule at thecalicoontheater.com.
It's the Local Edition. I'm Jason Dole. Today marks the 24th anniversary of the attacks on the World Trade Center in New York City on September 11th, 2001. Nearly a quarter century later, the 9/11 Memorial Museum is still pursuing its mission to commemorate, educate, and inspire. Radio Catskill's Patricio Rubio spoke with Beth Hellman, president and CEO of the 9/11 Memorial Museum in New York City, about the enduring significance of this anniversary and how the museum continues to share stories of resilience and remembrance.
It's hard to believe it's been 24 years, but it's also hard to believe we have 100 million Americans who are too young to remember 9/11 themselves. So I think what sticks out for me is how important it is to connect to new generations and share with them the stories of how challenging that day was and the remarkable response, you know, the courage and the compassion, the service that was inspired by 9/11, and how people came together. You know, literally, they saw people they hadn't even seen before when they realized what was happening in their neighborhoods, in their communities, especially here in the New York area, but really across the country.
Yeah, and for me, when you say that, just first thing I think is that to see how folks did come together on that day and the days after and the weeks after, the months after. It was really the first time I experienced in my life that folks came together like that, whether you're on the left side of the aisle or the right side of the aisle in politics or whatever. It seems like folks really came together to help each other, not only at the scene, at the site, but also afterwards, just comforting each other.
Absolutely. You know, we learned a lot about how to get through an attack as terrible as 9/11, how to recognize the losses that people suffered who were closest to the consequences of the attacks, including the people who came to help and then suffered consequences on their health from responding to the World Trade Center site and breathing in the dust that was toxic. And so those stories are a big part of how the history continues to evolve. So we're interested in remembrance. We want never to forget. We want to make sure people don't forget. And we're interested in continuing to learn more and understand what's happening today as a result of 9/11.
And one of those initiatives, I understand, the museum has set a goal to reach 20 million students by the 25th anniversary next year. How do you plan to accomplish this? And why does that matter?
Teachers across the country have told us they want to teach and they don't always have access to the materials that they need to reach their students. So we continue to do more to make that possible. We've reached 5 million students through our digital learning experience. So on the anniversary every year, we publish and make available free of charge a video that has first-person accounts, eyewitnesses, stories of people themselves, and they're deeply affected by 9/11. And that really moves people to hear those authentic stories. That's available at 911memorial.org/DLE. Like the memorial itself, which is free of charge, that's free of charge. All of our educational resources are free. And then when we students in the museum who can actually get here to the museum, it's free for students to come from the tri-state area. Our fall programs are the field trips for students. It's available online now for teachers to sign up at 911memorial.org.
Mm. Now, I understand that there's a new exhibition of children's art. If you want to talk a little bit about that and sort of how it reflects the way young people connect to 9/11.
You know, one of the things we learned from 9/11 was the consequences of that kind of harm on people over the long term and how we can best support them moving ahead. And no one was more affected than the children who lost parents on that day. Some of those children and then other kids as well, because it wasn't only those kids, but others created art in the aftermath of 9/11, guided by artists and teachers, educators, therapists who wanted to help them recover. So that new exhibition in the museum draws on that art that was created to show how people came together, how we used our understanding and we grew our understanding of how to help people respond, and how incredibly resilient children can be when facing that kind of challenge.
Right. And the story of 9/11 is ongoing. You know, nearly 25 years later, the health effects on first responders and survivors remain a major part of the 9/11 story. I think we want to talk a little bit about how does the museum honor and amplify those ongoing struggles?
It's such an important way of the way the museum has changed in recent years. We've changed the design of the Memorial Plaza to add a glade that recognizes the contributions, the sacrifices of all those folks who responded, union workers, laborers, first responders, the survivors in the community, the people who just lived here who were affected by that dust. We also have a new part of our 9/11 commemoration where we have a moment of tribute in that glade to recognize those people who have lost family members and who continue to suffer from the effects of that. There's an installation in the museum called Dust, Illness and Advocacy After 9/11 that reminds visitors of the tenacity that people fought for recognition and treatment and compensation for the people who were suffering. And for everybody who's in the World Trade Center Health Program, about 140,000 people, we offer free admission to the museum. And we try to make sure everybody knows how they, if they're eligible, can become a part of that World Trade Center Health Program, which monitors and offers treatment to the people who are suffering from health effects related to their service here.
Now, as someone who's leading this work, You know, I just want to know, what has been the most meaningful or challenging part of ensuring that 9/11 is remembered, you know, with not only with compassion, but also accuracy?
I think getting history right is never a task that's done. I think we have to continue to fight to understand better what people went through. You know, the stories of 9/11, almost 3,000 people were killed that day. What happened and the response is among the most compelling narratives out there. But we don't know everything about what happened that day. And each one of those people has a story of their life before that day that we also want to share with the people who visit the museum. And I think maybe hardest about being here at the Memorial Museum is realizing the emotion and the intensity that continues to affect people when they remember that day and they reckon with what it meant for them and the world that it changed so much. But definitely the best part is to see people come together. When you see the communities, the groups of family members, the first responders, the survivors, our volunteers, the people who are just in the museum witnessing and experiencing and learning themselves how classes come together around lessons like this, that's a really powerful thing, especially at this time.
You know, I lived in the city during 9/11, and I just remember how different the city was and still is. I feel like it's like after 9/11, the city's changed, and you can still see the remnants of that with security that's going on, how buildings have adapted to secure themselves, and you know, just how the subways got more police force and more secure because of the threats from 9/11. It just seems like we still have those remnants of 9/11 in those parts.
No, that's so true. Sometimes things change in ways you don't really see, and then all of a sudden later you notice that they've changed. And sometimes on days like 9/11, it feels like everything changes all at once, and there's really no going back. The city certainly felt different after 9/11, and you're right, in many ways has continued. Those changes have not gone back. It's one reason, too, New Yorkers aren't always ready to visit us. We have free admission on the first Sunday of every month, thanks to the Carnegie Foundation, for New Yorkers who want to visit the museum who haven't had a chance to come yet. We realized that a specified time when people could come who were New Yorkers, who remember that, or who want to bring their families, we wanted to make it possible for them to come for free.
Yeah. Now, looking ahead to the 25th anniversary next year, I don't know if I'm sure there's already plans for, I know every year that there is a remembrance and you know, I hear it on the radio and watch it on TV. But looking ahead to the 25th anniversary, is there anything special planned or a kind of message that's going to be given out?
Well, remembrance and service are themes for the 25th anniversary. You know, every day in the museum is a special day for the people who encounter those stories and who visit. But the 25th anniversary is a big time for a milestone anniversary for 9/11 itself. Also, America 250, a time when the country's persistence and where it is today is going to be at center stage too. And we really want to lean into the unity and the service that was inspired by 9/11. People chose to do so many things in that aftermath. Some people left. Some people didn't stay. Some obviously, almost 3,000 people were killed, but their families went on. Their children became firefighters and teachers and therapists and service members. They did all kinds of things to try to help and to contribute, and their lives were redirected. And so that's what we expect to focus on in our exhibitions and in our outreach around the 25th anniversary.
Beth, what message do you hope the nation and the world carries forward about 9/11?
I think the capacity of New York City to recover is a stand-in for the capacity of the world to recover from the most challenging things. The fact that the World Trade Center is again a thriving hub of commerce and culture, the fact that people have not forgotten and that we can continue to remember, and that the World Trade Center is anchored by a memorial that's free and open to the public and a sacred space of remembrance for the people who were killed by those terrorist attacks that day. I think that's a positive message for moving ahead. And I think it's one that can make it possible for people to deal with other things that they're facing out there too.
Well, we were talking to the president and CEO of the 9/11 Memorial and Museum, Beth Hillman. Thank you so much for talking to us, Beth, about this really important time in our lives and marking the 24th anniversary on 9/11. Thank you so much. I do really appreciate it.
Thanks, Patricia. Take good care.
In Liberty, I'm Patricio Roballo for Radio Catskill.
Thank you, Patricio, for that report. And thank you, listener, for being here with me tonight. I'm Jason Dole. Patricio will be your host tomorrow night on the Local Edition. Stay with us at 7 for Ramble Tamble with Claire. But for now, it's more news from The Daily. This is Radio Catskill.
Sports. Celebrate 35 years of Radio Catskill at the Lou Beach Community House Summer Jubilee. Join us this Saturday from 5 to 8 p.m. for live music from Calla Sun and Lolly and the Pops and a DJ set by The Mixtape's Jason Tugon, plus cold beer from Catskill Brewery. Tickets are $25 and proceeds benefit Radio Catskill. More information at wjffradio.org. The Lou Beach Community House Summer Jubilee.